As the video showed, we're in a series called So That You May Know. It's taken from 1 John 5:13. We've been going through the letters of the Apostle John. And throughout the last 10 Sundays, we primarily have been in 1 John. And today we're going to study 2 and 3 John in one day. 1 John is a lengthy letter, and I think we could describe 2 and 3 John. They're the two shortest books in the Bible. They're more like postcards. They're short and to the point. The situations that John is writing into in 2 and 3 John are very similar to 1 John. After following Christ as one of his disciples, John became a significant leader in the early church, being a leader in various cities as churches were starting and growing and maturing. And he's writing to some of these churches that he has a relationship with later on in life that he's no longer a part of but still wants to bless and encourage because he recognizes that they're struggling. And it's kind of hard for us to picture what this church would be like because it's different than this. They met in homes. There was no more than 100 people who would be in a church like this. And because of that, they were susceptible or vulnerable in a few specific ways. First of all, because they're small, they had no cultural power. And so they were susceptible to worldliness or being drawn into the society around them because they were so unlike everything around them. And then secondly, because they were small, if someone that was in the church left or someone who was in the church started teaching something that wasn't true, all of them could feel the impact of being pulled astray and kind of wondering, why are these people leaving? Why are these people teaching something different than what we have been taught? And so John is writing to encourage them and to remind them of what is really true about them. It's a letter, 1 John, of assurance. And he's focusing his assurance on saying that you bear these marks of Jesus in your life. And if you've been here at all in the last 10 weeks, we've talked a lot about obedience, love, and devotion. And what he's saying to them is, you have these things true in your life. You have Christ. And he's reminding them of the significant foundation that they have. And 2 and 3 John, he's going to take these kind of foundational themes that we've been looking at and then look at it in an even more specific way. Now that you have this assurance, this foundation of Christ in your life, now you can live as people of love and people of truth in the world around you. You have that secure place, and so you can live in a specific way. And these two themes of truth and love are going to be our primary focus today. And I love the way that Tim Keller, who was a pastor in New York City for a long time, here's how he describes the significance of two things that we separate, truth and love, and the importance of bringing them together. He says, love without truth is sentimentality. It supports and affirms us, but keeps us in denial about our flaws. Truth without love is harshness. It gives us information, but in such a way that we cannot really hear it. Now, I don't think this is quite a perfect analogy, but I think of being a follower of Christ as a person of truth and love as kind of like driving a car with a gas pedal and a brake pedal. The brake pedal in the analogy would be the example of truth. Being a person of truth. The brake pedal keeps you from going off the road. It keeps you from driving too fast. It protects you from getting in a car accident when you're about to hit someone. It keeps you in line. Without it, we crash. But love, then, in this example, is the gas pedal. Without love, you're just stuck in the driveway. You're not really moving forward and making a difference with your life. The gas pedal pushes us forward. And it's the disciple of Christ, or the challenge of being a disciple of Christ, is learning how to use both pedals, the gas and the brake, love and truth. We're meant to operate not with just love or just truth, but with both in the way that we engage the world around us. And in his gospel account, John even describes Jesus as full of grace or love and truth. And here in 2 and 3 John, as we go through it, I think we'll see John's focal point is now that we have assurance, let's build our lives as being people of love and people of truth. So today we're going to read in its entirety all of 2 John. It's 13 verses long, so if you have a Bible, you could turn there to 2 John. It's 13 verses long, the short postcard sort of letter. And then as we're working our way through studying and talking about 2 John, we're going to pull in pieces from 3 John. So in some way, we're kind of covering both books on the same day. So 2 John, starting with this. The elder to the lady chosen by God and to her children, whom I love in the truth, and not I only, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth which lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and love. It has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us. And now, dear lady, I am not writing you a new command, but one we have had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you have heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. I say this because many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. Watch out that you do not lose what we have worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully. Anyone who runs ahead and does not continue in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever continues in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take them into your house or welcome them. Anyone who welcomes them shares in their wicked work. I have much to write to you, but I do not want to use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to visit you and talk to you face to face so that our joy may be complete. The children of your sister who is chosen by God send their greetings. This is the word of the Lord, the book of 2 John. And it starts off in kind of a confusing way. We're used to many New Testament letters state who's writing it and who they're writing to, a person or a church in a specific location, but that's not what 2 John does at all. The author is named the Elder, which is probably just a title that John was known by to the people that he was writing to, kind of a nickname for him. He was known as the Elder, and so this was an easily identifiable way for him to announce himself as writing the letter. And it says that the elder is writing this letter or postcard to the lady. Now, who is the lady? Now, more than likely, what I think John is doing here is he's building off of New Testament language for the church. Paul, in Ephesians 5, describes the church as the bride of Christ, using feminine language around the body of people, which is the church. John builds on this in Revelation 19, where he similarly describes the church as the bride of Christ in referring to the marriage supper of the Lamb, when the church will join herself fully with Jesus the Messiah in glorious perfection. Again, the bride of Christ. So it seems likely that what John is doing is he is writing a letter to a church or churches, the lady. And the lady's children are then the people of the church that he's writing to. And interestingly, 3 John and 2 John both start off the same way. Even though 3 John's written to an individual person named Gaius, 2 John and 3 John start the same. And so I'll put these together so you can see this. 2 John 1, to the lady chosen by God and to her children, whom I love in the truth. 3 John 1, written to Gaius, to my dear friend Gaius, whom I love in the truth. That statement, whom I love in the truth, is foundational to what John wants to say in 2 and 3 John. He wants to talk about love and he wants to talk about truth. And the reason why he's focusing his thoughts on this at the beginning of his letter is because he's saying this bond of love that he has with the church and with his friend Gaius is foundational to the truth. Meaning, they have an understanding of the truth that's mutual, and it's this mutual love for the truth that brings a love that they have for one another. Oftentimes, we think of love in emotional terms or attractional terms. John's talking about love in truth terms. We have an understanding of the truth that creates an intimacy that we have with one another, a love for one another. So what I'd like to do, working through 2 John and then taking some of 3 John to speak to what 2 John is emphasizing, is talk about being people of love and then talk about being people of truth. And then at the end, take these two things that we quite easily separate. We can be one or the other, but both very hard. Talk about how we bring these things together. So, what does it mean, according to 2 John and 3 John, to be people of love? He starts off by saying that people of love then live the command, because loving one another is a command he gives us here. Live the command because they've received the gift. Back in 1 John 3:11, John, among many other places in 1 John, emphasized that this command that's given is not something that's brand new, but something of old. 1 John 3:11, this is the message you have heard from the beginning. We should love one another. Almost an echo exactly of what he says here in 2 John 5. He's reiterating his point because it's clearly very important to him that they would embody what he is emphasizing and teaching. But what's interesting about John's story, his life story, is that this message of love that he's preaching isn't always something he lived. And we have examples of this all throughout the Gospels. And here's just a few examples of John early on following Christ and growing in maturity. In Luke chapter 9, John and his brother James have just gone to a Samaritan village with Jesus and some other disciples, and the Samaritan village did not welcome Jesus. And John and James are mad. They're furious. And they're calling out to Jesus saying, we should call down fire from heaven to just burn this place to smithereens. We hate these people. That's what he's saying. And Jesus rebukes them, calling them judgmental and inviting them to embody mercy instead of judgment. And then you could fast forward also to Matthew 20, where John isn't judgmental, but he's selfishly ambitious. In Matthew 20, John is probably standing right next to his mom, and his mom approaches Jesus, and she says to him, I want you to take my two sons, John and James, and let them sit at your right hand and at your left hand of the Father in heaven as you rule forever. And you can imagine the kind of controversy or problems that arose among the disciples. Well, why the two of you and why not the rest of us? Why are you guys so important? And the sense that we get, even though John wasn't saying these things to Jesus, he didn't stop his mom. So clearly there was a part of him that longed for this kind of selfish ambition to be raised up. But that's who John was, and it's not very clearly who he became, because he became known as the Apostle of Love, something he taught about, something that he embodied in his life. So something changed. And we maybe even get an example of what caused this change by something that John wrote about in John chapter 13. It's the only gospel account that describes Jesus as washing the feet of the disciples. And it could have been that that moment or others where Jesus, the one worthy of highest honor, the highest place, takes the place of the lowest servant. This humble love that Jesus had for others could have had a remarkable shift that caused in John. John changed because he received a gift from Jesus, the love of God, poured out in his life through the sacrifice of Christ. We don't simply live toward others in a way that's loving because we're commanded, though 1st and 2nd John and 3rd John command us to love others. We don't live with love toward others because we're commanded. We live with others because we've received a gift of love that we didn't earn and we don't deserve. John was a man known for selfish ambition, for fiery judgment, and he became the apostle of love. And he reminds us in 1 John 4 that we love because he first loved us. This love that we receive becomes the love that we extend. We live this command because we've received a gift. But he goes on. In the next verse, he begins to describe in more specifics, well, what does it then mean or look like to love others? People of love not just have received a gift, but they have also, they then practice costly care that puts obedience into action. John wants to get this idea of love as an emotion exclusively out of our minds, to think of love more specifically as an action lived out toward others. He says in verse 6, and this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you have heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. Love is an action, according to verse 6, not a feeling. And if you read ahead into 3 John, we're given a positive example of someone who put costly care into obedience through their actions toward others. We don't know the man that 3 John is written to. It's a guy named Gaius. He's not written about anywhere else in the New Testament. But what we learned about him from John in just the short amount of verses in 3 John is quite remarkable, because John says that nothing brings him more joy than seeing Gaius and others like him live out their faith through love toward others. In fact, he says about him in 3 John verse 5, "Dear friend, you are faithful in what you are doing for the brothers and sisters, even though they are strangers to you." And what is likely happening, or what John is referring to here, is that Gaius had been hospitable to traveling missionaries who had come to the town where he lived. And his generosity gained a reputation to the point where others knew about it and told John about it, even though he lived a far distance away. His generosity was sacrificial. And what he shows us is that true love costs something. True love costs something. To truly love another person, it will cost you your time, it will cost you your energy, and it will cost you your money. True love will eventually be what can feel like, at least, an inconvenience. You have to go out of your way and your natural inclination to do something for another. Now, Jesus taught us that it is better to give than receive. And those of us who have given to another know that oftentimes when we give, what we receive back is far greater than what we give. But we can't overlook the reality that giving to others often costs something. And it can be a struggle to be willing to give of ourselves in some specific ways. And in my experience in navigating life with other believers, I think oftentimes as God works on our hearts, we're willing to give of our time, of our energy. We'll serve in some specific ways to try and care for others. But what is often a struggle for many believers is giving of our money. Money seems for many believers to be like the last idol that we hold on to and think of this stuff that we have, this money that we've accumulated, as ours and not a gift from God to us. Jesus talks a lot about money. In the parables of the New Testament Gospels, 25% of the parables are about money. So it's a focal point of Jesus that he gives a lot. And as I've sensed this aspect of our church, I have seen what I sense is a struggle around money and being willing to freely give to the Lord. Each month, the elders of our church look at two things as it relates to the finances of the church. They look at the overall giving for the month and the overall expenses, and they look at the number of households who are participating in giving. That doesn't mean they're looking and seeing who's given and who hasn't. It's just the overall amount that they're looking at for those things. And an interesting thing has happened throughout this calendar year. You all have been very generous, And the giving of our church has exceeded the expenses, which is great because it means that all of our staff are able to keep their roles, all of our ministries have been well supported financially, and everything that we had planned to do, we've been able to do. But there's another interesting thing that's happened, is that we as a church have grown. This morning is an example of that. There are more people here today than there were at approximately a year ago. More people who are a part of our church, and yet there are less people month to month supporting our church financially. Now, I don't share that as a guilt trip or as a way to try and get you to give or anything like that. I share that more as an invitation. I think for many people, one of the last things that they struggle to give to the Lord is their money because they think it's theirs. But what the Bible is very clear about is that everything that we have is given to us by the Lord. And if it's all His, then giving a portion of it back to Him in some way is a form of obedience. And so I don't share this lightly. I was sharing, you know, my intention of talking about this with somebody else, and I said, I don't think I've talked about money in any way in like the last year. I could be wrong about that. So I'm not bringing this up as like, if you're new with us today, you're like, of course, I'm at church and the pastor's talking about money. That's all pastors talk about. That is not my goal or intention. I'm trying to talk about what it looks like to be loving people who are generous with their time and their resources in a variety of ways. And so here's the challenge I want to give you. For those of you that have been and are supporting our church financially, I say thank you. And what would it look like to give more? What would it look like to release even more to the Lord? And for those of you that haven't been supporting the church financially, what would it look like to give something? Something, as I said to somebody else recently, something is better than nothing. Something is better than nothing. Start somewhere. And the Bible actually encourages us on this specific thing, to test the Lord. In Malachi chapter 3, to test the Lord around financial giving to Him. And I think what the text is saying there is an invitation to test the Lord, like if you will willingly give back to the Lord what He has in portion given to you, will the Lord still take care of you and provide for your needs? That's what it looks like to test the Lord. Be generous to God in some specific ways and see if He doesn't continue to meet your needs. And actually, in my experience, what I think happens in the life of a believer that's willing to let go of some of what God has given them is they start to have a different relationship with money, that it no longer has this stranglehold on their lives where they feel this need to have more and more and more. They can start to hold on to what God has given more freely, and it releases them, and they get to start to experience a freedom with money instead of always feeling like they need more and more. And I think that that is exactly what John is trying to highlight about what he sees exemplary in Gaius, in his actions. What he sees happening in him is that he is freely giving to the Lord in some specific ways to care for and to support other believers who are coming through town. So this is the first part of 2 and 3 John, being people of love. And now as 2 John continues on, we'll see that he kind of transitions to talk about what it looks like to be people of truth. And again, I want to just draw us into a couple different points of emphasis that he makes in these two books. The first is around being people of truth is that we have to guard our lives from falsehoods. Guard our lives from falsehoods. And he says this essentially in verses 7 and 8. He says, many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. And this is where I get this idea of guarding your lives. Watch out that you do not lose what we have worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully. What John is doing, like he's done with love, is he's reiterating the importance of truth and guarding ourselves from falsehoods. He made a bunch of emphasis on this in 1 John. And he even goes a step further here in 2 John in verse 10 to say that if there are those who are teaching falsehoods, that if you take them into your home or welcome them, you're opening yourself up to vulnerability in your own life. So for us thinking about, well, what does that mean for us? Does that mean like if you have connections to other people who aren't believers and they believe some different things than you, you shouldn't invite them into your home, or you shouldn't get together with them for coffee or have a conversation with them? No, I don't think that's what John is emphasizing here. Back in John's day, to invite someone into your home was a way of signaling that you were embracing what they taught. So if you brought a false teacher into your home, it was your way of showing to the other believers that you're in fellowship with that this is what you believe. And so he's trying to push them away from the falsehoods that they're prone to accept. And his primary concern here is the reality of vulnerability. He's focusing on their vulnerability as believers, that false ideas and the people who bring them can take root in your heart and in your mind and then cause you to start living in a way that is contrary to what God teaches in his word and ultimately lead you away from Christ. And so we have to be proactively on our guard, recognizing that each of us is vulnerable to being swept away from the truth. About a month ago, there was a news story that caught my attention that many of you probably heard about. The Louvre in Paris was robbed. I don't know if you saw this news story, but they weren't just robbed. They were robbed of $100 million of jewelry. And so you can see a picture of the museum in Paris there. And after it happened, I read a little bit about it because it was interesting to me, in part because the museum was robbed by seven people after the museum was opened at 9:30 in the morning in broad daylight. Really incredible how they were able to pull this off. Now, thankfully, almost all of them have been arrested. Almost all the jewelry has been brought back. So everything's relatively okay. It's just kind of interesting to study how this happened. And what I read about is that they did an audit of their security system afterwards to try and figure out how this happened. And what they discovered and what they reported to the news is that the security camera system of the museum had a flaw, meaning it had a vulnerability. And the vulnerability was that it had a very easy password to figure out. You could log into the system because the password for it was Louvre. It's kind of like putting your computer password or your phone password as like zeros or ones, or your computer password is password, really innovative. Like, that's a little bit vulnerable. And in the same way, what John is saying here is you can have all the showings of spiritual maturity and sophistication on the outside of your life, but unless you're guarded against falsehoods, you're vulnerable to being swept away from the truth. And so that means we have to be careful with the inputs that we allow into our lives. And I think we inherently understand this, because when it comes to eating food, all of us would generally agree that if you only eat unhealthy food over and over and over, eventually your body will become unhealthy as well. And that same thing applies spiritually. If all you take into your life is unhealthy inputs, eventually you will be led astray from the foundational truth of the Lord. Slowly, often subtly, these inputs can shift our convictions, they can dull our discernment, and they make us vulnerable to ideas that on the outside seem harmless. Everybody says this, everybody believes this, everybody in our society follows this, but they can pull us away from the truth. No one wakes up one day and decides, well, I want to be deceived, so I guess I'll go down that path. This is usually a slow fade of attrition away from the Lord toward these false ideas. These unexamined inputs in our lives can easily lead us astray. And John even wants to give us a specific example, and he highlights one aspect in the negative of being a person of truth, specifically in 3 John. He talks about a man named Diotrephes. And here's what he says, really highlighting something that surprised me about being a person of truth in the way that he focuses it. People of truth refuse self-centeredness. Now, just like me, you might not draw a direct connection between self-centeredness and being pulled into falsehood. But that's exactly what John is saying. Here's what he says about this man. He says, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will not welcome us. So when I come, I will call attention to what he is doing, spreading malicious nonsense about us. Diotrephes is John's living example of what happens when the truth is no longer anchored and on guard in our lives. We're vulnerable to start thinking and doing life in other ways. And we see his selfish ambition, which is what John really highlights here. Augustine, who is an ancient church father, said that all sin flows from the place of selfish pride. All sin flows through selfish pride. And Diotrephes is an example of that. Here was a man of influence in the church who used his place of influence for his own selfish gain. Not as a way of caring for or protecting the flock that was under his care, but for his own selfish ambition. And John even exposes something specific about how he did this. He says he used malicious nonsense. His speech was malicious nonsense. Not just nonsense, but even beyond that, empty accusations, gossip without substance. In other words, he was talking a lot, but saying nothing of truth. And he weaponized his words in order to tear others down so he could prop himself up, distorting reality to keep power and influence for himself. And I think this is often the way that deception works in our world, that when our hearts are driven by motivation for ourselves, the truth becomes negotiable and easily manipulated for our own gain. And what we see happening with Diotrephes is a drift from truth that caused him to abandon the Christian expression of love. He was moving away from the truth that caused him to be unloving toward others. And kind of a mental picture that I have of this is this shift away from the truth by being self-focused and self-centered is kind of like being in the bathroom when you have a hot shower going. First, you start off and you look at yourself right in the mirror and you can see yourself perfectly. But eventually, the mirror gets really foggy and your connection to reality is completely distorted because you can't see anything through the mirror. It's all gone. That's the kind of idea that John is highlighting here, that focusing exclusively on yourself causes you to lose sight of reality and to start to distort the truth for your own personal gain. Well, here's the amazing thing about our God in a way that is really challenging for us. We talked about truth and we talked about love. And I would imagine that any one of us are maybe a little bit more drawn toward truth or a little bit drawn toward love. And in specific interactions that we have with family and friends, we're probably loving or truthful, but it is really hard to be truthful and loving at the same time. But that's exactly how God is described all throughout the scriptures, like Psalm 89. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Unfailing love and truth walk before you as attendants. God brings together truth in love. But we tend to one or the other. Diminish one, highlight another. Whenever we diminish truth and only embrace love, we compromise what's real in favor of what feels good. This is how we come up with phrases like my truth, which is nothing. It means nothing. There's no such thing as my truth. There's only the truth, and we submit and surrender ourselves to it. This is where we come up with ideas like you can do whatever you want or be whoever you want. But that path only leads to moral indifference and a lack of accountability in our lives, and it leads us astray. And there's no true life to be found in this way. And when we diminish love and only emphasize and highlight the truth, we might be right, but no one wants to listen to somebody that only knows they're right and doesn't want to be loving. And this way, the truth gets used like a club or a sword just to damage. It's harsh. It comes at people in a way they don't want to receive it. And it also leads us into legalism, self-righteousness, judgmentalism, and an inability to extend forgiveness toward others when they wrong us. But what we see embodied in Jesus is love and truth brought together in the same way at all times. It's easy to ignore, it's an easy path to ignore truth and assume love as a way of giving unconditional affirmation. And to ignore truth or to ignore love and embrace truth without care for someone else. Those are the easy ways to go about life. It's far more difficult to hold love and truth together in our interactions with others. There's a guy who wrote a book a few years ago. He was a former gay activist who became a follower of Christ. And here's how he kind of brings together these two ideas of love and truth that I think is really helpful. He says, unless we learn how to accept others without affirming everyone, we have lost the art of conversation because we're suppressing our honest opinions. We can accept and affirm people without agreeing with and affirming all their desires or beliefs or accepting their actions. And so what does this look like for us? I wish I could give you like a simple formula of here's how you live out love and truth in all interactions. But it's not that simple, right? It takes discernment. It takes the Lord's help, His leading and guidance. And the honest truth is like we're going to screw this up a lot trying to be loving and truthful. And so thank the Lord that He offers us forgiveness. And as we rely on Him, He enables us to do this as best that we can through His help. And here's the reality. Coming up in 4 days, all of us are going to have a really difficult opportunity to put into practice being people of love and truth. When you get together with friends and family, many of which do not see eye to eye with you on very many things. And so you're probably going to have some crazy uncle who's going to want to try and get you to debate your viewpoints on the current president. Or you're probably going to have another family member or cousin that wants to start talking about the Oregon gas tax and start having a debate about your viewpoints on all of these things. And you might have a strong opinion about those two things and many others. But those two things are a great example of dying on the hill of something that is not truth. That would be dying on the hill of opinion. You can have that debate, but you're dying on the hill of opinion, not something that's truthful. And so I think we want to be people of truth, but we die on the wrong hill of truth. And what assurance in Christ's security, knowing that He has bought for us salvation that we could not earn and that we do not deserve. What that kind of stability gives us is it releases us from the need to win, from the need to get the final word, from the need to be able to walk out of that dinner thinking like, I really told them, now they know the truth. We're released from needing to win the argument, to instead think about how can I hold on to the truth that I hold very personally about this, but to do it in a loving way? How can I make sure that person that I know, we don't see eye to eye on much, but I want them to walk out of here thinking they know I care about them? What does it look like then to be people who hold on to the truth? I'm not saying ignore it, but to do it with love and gentleness. This is how the New Testament talks about being people of love and truth. In 1 Peter 3, he encourages us to revere Christ in all things, but to do so with gentleness and respect. And in Romans 12, when Paul is writing about loving your enemies, he finishes off this long teaching on loving your enemies, and he says, as far as it's possible with you, live at peace with everyone. Isn't that striking? He doesn't say live at peace with the people you agree with, the family members you like, the ones that cheer for the same team or vote the same way you do. He says live at peace with everyone. That's challenging, right? And so none of this is easy, holding truth and love together. Here's how Paul describes this in Ephesians 4. He says, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ. The way to grow in our faith, empowered by the Lord, is to seek to be people of love and truth together. Love without truth has no anchor. And truth without love has no purpose. It's just defiant. But assured people who know that God has given them something that they could not earn and do not deserve, assured people with the security of relationship with the Lord get to walk as people of truth and love, knowing we don't have to win because victory has already been purchased for us. Let's pray together as we move into our time of response. Heavenly Father, I find this convicting because I can just think through just recent interactions where I was either loving, but I was timid toward the truth, or truthful, but I was pretty harsh with how I brought the truth. And you're inviting us into this posture of doing something that, quite frankly, doesn't come natural to us. We might be able to do one or the other, but to do love and truth well feels daunting. And so we're here prayerfully asking for your help. In a world where there is suspicion and division, we are inviting you to form us by your grace. When our hearts are defensive, would you soften us with your love? When our words are either timid or passive or harsh, would you anchor us in the truth and allow our opinions to be subservient to the truth? And would you teach us what it looks like to walk in the way of Jesus, he who is the example to us of love and truth? Empower us to love, to listen to others, and then to give us courage to speak with gentleness when the situation arises. And then would you send us out from this place, rooted in Christ, secure in him, depending on your Spirit, and helping us then to embody your presence into these places that you call us. And God, even more specifically, each of these people, they're going to share a meal with some friends and some family in 4 days. And undoubtedly, there will come an instance when holding grace and truth together will be very difficult. And I pray that even in that moment, that they'll think back to this text in the way that you're working in their heart as a reminder that they can be people of truth and love. Empower them in that moment to embody Christ. We ask for your help. In Jesus' name, amen.